You're listening to Homegrown. Welcome back. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Sweet Bobby Hill.
And oh my.
Wouldn't that be a great name for a fighter? They have those kind of names.
Yeah. But what about Spear Hill?
We talked about that last week, yeah.
Your middle name. I thought we were going to start calling you Spear.
Well, yeah, if I submit an unpublished manuscript that was full, it'd be Spear Hill.
Okay, so watch out for Spear Hill.
Run, don't hide if Spear Hill shows up on your...
on your bookshelf.
on your bookshelf.
All right, but welcome back indeed. Today on the show, we are going to learn a little bit more about sweet potatoes and a little bit more about roses.
Sweet potatoes are one of my favorite foods. I'm so glad we're doing this.
Yeah.
And apparently very healthy for you.
Yeah.
Because my wife feeds them to me morning, noon, and night now, just to keep me around for another few years.
They're very good.
I love them, and I just love everything. I love to take the skin off. Mm-hmm. I like the whole process of eating sweet potatoes is kind of fun to me. And then the beautiful, rich meat and that orange and some
just
reddish.
The taste of it, too.
Yeah.
And, like, they're so versatile. I like to make them spicy instead of, putting marshmallows on them.
And they're not yams either, as I understand.
They're not yams.
We're going to find out about that.
We are indeed. But we'll learn how to grow sweet potatoes from the sweet potato capital of the world, I would say. But it's Taterville in Gleason, in Gleason, Tennessee. They've been growing sweet potatoes and dealing with sweet potato stuff for a very, very long time.
55 years.
Yeah.
We're about to get it right.
There's a good family history to the business as well. So we look forward to talking to them. And just one funny note, we're not exactly sure who we're going to be talking to, because when I spoke to them, she said, "Oh yeah, somebody'll talk to you on, for your show, no problem." I'm like, "Can you tell me who?" And she said, "Well, whoever's not busy at the time," which is the beauty of like the family run business, don't you think? She's like, "Because honey, all of us can talk about it. Yeah. All of us know the history. All of us know." So I got a list of it being either, Larry or Kay or Kara
or Jethro, exactly.
So I figured that's fair, and
sure
we'll
is.
Just go with it, and we'll see. But it's somebody from the family, either a Steele or a Sanders or a Hudson, and we look forward to talking to them, whoever it is.
When you get involved in investigative sweet potato journalism, you get what you can take,
that's right, exactly. And Mr. Jim Preston, the president of the Louisville Rose Society, it's garden tour season, so Bob and I figured over the course of the next several weeks, we are going to go to people's gardens, check them out, learn from them. And first on the tour is Mr. Preston's rose garden.
Yeah, and I'm excited about roses, of course, because this year, as you saw for the first time, my 90-foot rose arbor is cranked up.
It looks great.
Right now, it's just dumb luck. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure what I'm doing, and I haven't really got diseases yet that are sure to come. So I want to talk to Jim myself about how to protect and what other climbing roses I might add to the mix.
Climbing roses are tougher than some of the other ones.
Yeah, I'm a little worried now because it's 10 feet high, and it's kind of cool, but at some point I got to get up there and prune them puppies.
Mm-hmm.
10 feet above the ground.
Yeah.
So I make it back to shrub roses about then.
You got to weigh the payoff with the dangers of the job, but right?
Jim knows the stuff. He's been at it really not quite that long. We'll hold the secrets back, but he's got a nice story how he got started in this stuff.
Cool. Sounds good.
Yeah.
All right. So that's coming up today. Hope that you'll stick with us. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Another thing when you garden, you hope to get, I do all the time about parades of things, parades of color, parade of this. This year I've got a parade of odor, fragrance for the first time. Not odor.
I was going to say fragrance suggests
odor,
a better smelling sort of thing.
But anyway, kind of going through the seasons, I've had fragrance
in
my garden.
There's a stench coming from the garden
for almost 6 weeks.
Wow.
The viburnums, and then the fothergillia, and then the roses, and the mock orange was fabulous, and now the clethra is yet to come.
Yeah.
So. Point being, you think about this stuff, folks, you can have fragrance in your garden for almost two months straight.
Right now, the calycanthus.
Oh, yeah.
Smelling
How did I forget
too?
About that?
I don't know. Yeah.
And they're great.
They're really
Athens
great.
And I Michael Lindsay. And so anyway, I've got fragrance in my garden.
Good for
and
you.
I'm pretty darn proud of it. How about you?
I have another nature story to tell you.
Let me have it.
Are you ready for this?
I'm not sure.
Take.
You look a little stricken.
A look at this. And folks, pretty amazing shots, if I do say so myself. Not just because I was there and I got my camera. So check out our website to look at this, because most people, I would say, I haven't seen this. I came across two snakes mating in a bluebird box at the end of my laundry line.
That old story, huh?
Oh, my goodness. And I have the utmost appreciation for nature. I'm not afraid of snakes. Snakes are welcome around the property. They, I got no problem with it. But it really was one of those, wild moments, and I don't mean like wild, like woo, wild party, wild, like feral wild moments, where you're awestrucken, but also sort of like queasy. It gave me the willies, and I kind of got sick to my stomach all in one foul swoop. Do you know what I mean?
Well, if you have two snakes mating in a bluebird box at the clothesline,
it's pretty amazing. Doesn't happen very often, right? Yeah. So I do the laundry, I hang my sheets out, and getting them off one evening, right? Mm-hmm. And then I look, and I noticed that the top of the bluebird box is on the ground. No bluebirds had babies in that box, thank goodness. They had one down the fence this year. And I look, and I'm like, oh my gosh, there's two snakes in there. You, like, their little heads are sticking out. Right. And like, they're big snakes. And obviously, they're of consensual age.
Ooh, close call.
And I'm like, Andy! So we get the camera, and we take a couple pictures. And then the following day, I'm out working, and basically, you all, I walk by this point like a million times every day. It's, you know, between the fence and the garage, and it's on the way back to the garden, whatever. So I'm checking them out, watching them. They're still there. They're still there. And then at one point, I notice that they are mating. And I mean, they're like, you can see.
They're writhing
the,
here.
You can see the male's little snake penis doing its thing. And it was just, it's kind of disgusting, but also amazing, like I said.
Yeah.
So I got some interesting photographs, and they mated, and then I went about, you know, my work, and then I came back and they were gone. So literally they were in that box for overnight into the next day.
Boy.
They mated, they finished, and then they moved on. And I hope they moved on, because I don't really want a million babies around the house either. But, you know, if that's what it is, that's what it is. But, I encourage you, if you're interested in those sorts of things, to check out the pictures, because I don't think many people get the opportunity to see an amazing sort of thing like that.
Well, I don't have clotheslines to begin with.
No kidding, but it kind of freaked me out. But
the,
it was also
the wine
really
was
cool.
Part of the deal, too, I think.
Yeah, it was too early in the day for that, but that came later to calm me down. All right, what's going on in your neck of the woods, Bob?
Precisely, the Jeffersonville Main Street Garden Tour and Plant Sale. It's going to be June 21st, hours 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., rain or shine. It starts at Preservation Park in Jeff, which is a neat little park right there, just off the main drag of Jeffersonville. They're doing a lot in downtown Jeffersonville.
They really are.
I mean, the streets, almost all the shops have something in them. Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on there. The riverfront is cool.
And the older houses are great.
Yeah,
and
they're building a pathway
great.
Along the river. So there's a lot to see in Jeffersonville. So just pop over the river, folks, unless you already live there. June 21st, 10 to 4 p.m., begin at Preservation Park at Preservation Station.
And there you go.
Ring their bell. $10 for a day, and it's well worth every bit of it.
That's right. All right, on to sweet potatoes. I got my sweet potatoes in several weeks ago after it really warmed up. First year I've ever grown sweet potatoes all by myself. And
well,
I remember mom.
And,
well, no, I mean, I remember mom and dad doing it, now that I'm in charge. So I'm excited to learn a little bit more to make sure that I have got a bumper crop.
Yeah. Can you call them taters too?
You can call them taters
sweet
because
taters.
The Tater Man and Taterville is in fact in Gleason, Tennessee, where the steel plant company is. The steel plant company came to my attention really because of a family business of growing sweet potatoes, certainly, but a letter from Dudley Sanders, who was called the Tater Man.
Oh, yeah.
That was dated December 6, 1982, Bob. The Tater Man was basically like spreading the word about growing sweet potatoes. And my father received one of the letters. This was 26 years ago. And I have the letter right here, too, in fact. So he was basically just really trying to get the rest of the country engaged and involved in growing sweet potatoes. They are still at it today. Generations of the Steele and Sanders family is still in the tater business down in Gleason, and today we have the pleasure of talking to them.
Hey there.
And this is Kay.
Yes.
Hi, Kay. How are you?
I'm doing well, and you?
Very good. Kay Hudson, my co-host, Bob Hill.
How are you?
And I'm Janine Wishy, and thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
Not a problem.
So listen, Kay, can you tell us a little bit about the history of the Steele Plant Company?
I can.
Great.
It's been a family-owned business in our family for, oh my goodness, as long as I can remember, but about 55, 56 years.
Uh-huh.
And my grandfather started it. He was W.C. Steele. And then my dad, who also taught school, married my mom and got into the business with him.
Oh, okay. And was your daddy Dudley?
Yes.
Okay, Dudley Sanders.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Okay, can you give us a sense of how big it was when you started and how big it is now in terms of acres and maybe number of slips and potatoes you
Well, when we first started the business, we did not grow our own potatoes. We bought the potatoes from other people who grew the potatoes. Now it's evolved into a year-round process where we do the plant shipping, which is our number one business, what we do in maybe April and May and first part of June. Mm-hmm. And then we take the plants and put them out in the field to grow the potatoes, so it's become a more year-round thing for mm-hmm. us. Mm-hmm. We usually raise about 35 to 40 acres per year.
Wow.
And how many we ship depends, I guess, basically on the demand. This year, the demand has been unbelievable. I honestly believe it's been the greatest demand we've ever had, and I think a lot of that might be, you know, the economy and people being a little bit afraid that, that the cost of food items is going to go up so much that they can't afford to feed their family, so they're going back to gardening. I just talked with a man this morning. He's 95, who has the best garden in his area, and he says people are trying to get him at 95 to raise things for them.
Right.
So,
well, you know, they need to make sure
demand
that
has been great. We can pull anywhere, I guess. When I say pull, that means get the slips out of the ground, 3.5 to 4 million sweet potato plants a year.
Okay, can you tell us the difference between yams and sweet potatoes and how many of each that you sell or grow?
Oh, my goodness. Now, that is probably the number one question that's asked on the phone and correspondence. And it's asked so often that we had to put something in our catalog to try to explain it. Personally, I really don't think there's a difference. What we talk about is the way that the moist flesh feels in your mouth during after it's cooked or baked. And these terms really do not refer to the moisture content of the potato. A yam is just basically a trade name that refers to the moist flesh of a sweet potato.
Okay.
And a dryer is the sweet potato.
And it depends on, I guess, how old you are when you ask, because elderly people that'll call that are, you say, 80 to 85, and they'll ask for yams, and we know what they want when they describe it.
Sure.
Then new gardeners sometimes don't have any idea the difference between a yam and a sweet potato, and actually what they want is a sweet potato, but they think they want a yam. So I think it's terminology as much as anything.
Okay, then how many different of each do you grow, or both?
Well, we have right now 12 different varieties of sweet potatoes. Probably our number one seller is the Beauregard. It's an easy potato to grow. It's probably what you would see commonly in your maybe chain
grocery store.
Stores like Sunflower, Kroger, whatever, you know, in particular area. It's probably our number one seller. Then there's Georgia Jets. That's a new potato. I shouldn't say new. Newer than the Bunch Puerto Rica and newer than the Centennial. Some of those older varieties are what, and the white yam are what the older gardeners ask for, because that's all they know. Just like anything else, there's a lot of production in trying to improve a potato. You know, they'll cross it with one thing. There's a new potato that we're investigating the use of. And sometimes you have to really watch, you know, what kind of potato you offer, but at the same time, you want to offer the best potato that gets the best yield that possibly can be for a northern gardener, a good potato that, you know, their soil might produce, you know, well for them. So we have about 12 varieties, but really and truthfully, some of those varieties, we have minimal sales on those varieties. We just try to keep those around to please maybe some of our older gardeners.
So for us in Kentucky and southern Indiana, are there varieties that are going to be a little bit better for us because we're a teeny bit, you know, more north than you all? Because sweet potatoes like it really hot, right?
Right. What you really, I guess, have to evaluate is your first frost date. Now, we're having a late spring, a late shipping season here, and we're not going to be finished shipping until probably the middle part of June. So we've got to set out our crop after we finish shipping, and but we're going to be okay in the south here in Tennessee because our frost is not going to be till far later than most. So we're going to be okay, even if we have some potatoes like the Bunch Puerto Rica that have about 120 days to yield. So what I would suggest in your area is you can probably would go with the Georgia Jet or the Vardaman or the Beauregard, because those are 90 to 100 day matures. You could possibly even do the Bunch Puerto Rica or the Nancy Hall, which are about 110 days of maturity. We have one variety now that's a new variety. It has a deep red skin. It's called the Japanese, and it's a light creamy color flesh. Very unusual flavor. It kind of cooks up dry, but it's very sweet, and it'll mature in about 120 days. So you just kind of have to talk to the customer, find out what they're interested in, if they like a baby baker, if they like... if they want to enter it in some kind of contest or fair, and then you make a suggestion based on the information they give you as to what you might recommend would be the best particular potato for that area.
Now, Kay, do you ship only slips or do you sell potatoes?
Well, our biggest thing is to ship just the sweet potato plants. We have done some sweet potatoes, some shipping of some sweet potatoes. We have a machine that washes those potatoes, and we have done some work with a big firm in our area called Aiken and Porter, who have transported our sweet potatoes across the United States. But that's not basically what we rely on. We're pretty much of just a plant business.
So, Kay, let me ask you this. Unlike regular, not I don't want to say white potatoes because potatoes come in all different colors, but the regular potato, we usually plant seed potatoes, like little chunks of potato cut up. But when you plant sweet potatoes, you plant the slips or the little plants that we're talking about. So you can you sort of take us through the steps of planting your slips, any sort of care and cultivation that your sweet potatoes need, and then how do we know when to harvest them and the best way to store them?
Yes.
From start to finish.
Okay. This might be the area where I'm not as knowledgeable. I do ride the sweet potato setter, but I'm involved. I'm a school teacher as well, and I'm not involved in the cultivation part of it. But I can tell you definitely what we need to do to get started. We'll work up our ground, and it has to be healed up. Sweet potatoes have to be set in a hill. And then we spray prior to setting out our potatoes. And then it's much like a tobacco setter. I don't know if you're familiar with what that looks like.
Oh, yeah.
We're in Kentucky, yes, ma'am.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's probably what you know. So we use a setter, a couple of tractors and setter, and then we have a trailer that goes behind, and any particular slot that's missed, then the trailer will follow behind there and be sure that the dirt kind of, covers them and seals
mounds
them.
Up, yeah.
And we'll do that. Sometimes it takes 3 to 4 weeks, depending on the weather, to get about 40 acres set out. We'd like to do it in less time, but sometimes with weather conditions, it takes sometimes up to 3 weeks to get those. Once all our plants are set out, then we get on our knees and pray for rain. We'll also spray after that, and we have to watch what we spray, because what will kill a kookaburra, which is a common, and a morning glory is a common weed that we deal with that's treacherous for the sweet potato, will also kill the sweet potato. So, and because we're Tennessee State certified, we have to watch what kind of chemical we put on our potatoes because they're dug for, consumption, human consumption, so you have to be very careful with that as well. So once we get them sprayed, then we start hoeing them, and that's definitely by hand, and probably not my favorite part of the whole process.
No.
But we hoe them out by hand and weed them, and then we'll come back in and throw dirt to them with plows and heal it up to be sure if any of the dirt was knocked away in the spraying and by the setter. Then we will throw the dirt back to them, and then hopefully we can, what we call it is laid by. They look, when they cover the ground and they seal that moisture in if we've had rain, and then we just need about a I would say ideal would be a couple of rains a month after they're covered the ground. We'll hold them, then we'll start digging the potatoes, or cultivating, I guess is what you would say, mid part of September. Sometimes, usually it's about the Monday after Labor Day, and we'll start with those that are 90-day matures, and we'll get the early maturing ones out of the ground first, and then we'll the ones that are 110 to 120 days, we try to leave them as long as we can. And sometimes we cut it close with the first frost and with a lot of things, but it usually works out pretty well for us.
I've often seen people, at least around here, say, wait to the first frost, you know, at the end of the season to kind of nip everything back, and then you can dig your sweet potatoes, you know, in your home garden, not the
right,
the,
right. That's
the number
that's what
you
I've
all
also
have.
Heard as well.
Yeah.
Well, Kay, then what's the next step? You dig the potato, then what? How do you get the slips to the customers from there?
Well, then we take the potatoes and we put them in beds. We put the potatoes down, then we put a sawdust, and we put like a mixture, I don't want to say wire, but it's stuff to keep the potatoes from moving, and mm-hmm. then we'll cover them with sawdust and then black paper, and then wait till they come through. We call it busting the paper, and we can kind of say that. Then we take the black paper off, and then the potatoes shoot up through the sawdust. And then whenever
so
they shoot up through
on
the
their
sawdust,
own.
Then we know pretty much when they're ready to be pulled. We have some greenhouses that have hot water underneath them, and because we can regulate the heat,
okay.
then it makes us be able to bring some on a little sooner than we normally would with just outside weather conditions, because some people are some of the southern gardeners in Florida and Georgia and Arkansas, Alabama, mm-hmm. some of those can use them by May 15th.
So,
by April 15th.
So, okay, basically you're harvesting the potatoes, then you're storing them and turning them into like little sprout machines, right?
That's exactly
so they
right.
So they create that little slip. You harvest that slip from the potato, and that's what you sell to the customer.
That's right.
Then the bulk of your customers are just backyard gardeners.
A big majority of them are. They are. Yes, sir. We have some. We have a lot of wholesale business as well, gardens and nurseries that. Mm-hmm.
Slips.
And seed stores that, you know, people come by and they're going to buy their seeds, and they're going to also buy their sweet potato plants. But the bulk of ours is small orders, small okay. gardeners.
Is anybody else in Tennessee or Kentucky or that area doing the same thing as you guys?
Yes, sir, there is. There's a friend of ours in a neighboring town that does some work with this. When we first started, my grandfather started, there was like three or four people in Gleason that did it. And now I'm telling you, it's a scarce business, I think, because it's a whole lot of work. Honestly, some people don't want to get out there and work hard at it because it is backbreaking work and hard work. But we do know a few people that still do it, but, we're probably have more volume, I guess, than most of the people that we know.
Well, we appreciate your hard work, Kay,
yes,
and
ma'am.
The rest of the family.
Well, thank you very much. Uh-huh. I appreciate my daughter told me that she talked with you and that you have a handwritten letter that was written by my father.
I do, indeed. He was
an absolutely wonderful man.
It's actually typed, but it is signed December 6, 1982.
Oh, my goodness. Well, he became ill in 1986 and then died of a brain tumor in 1990.
Yes, I'm sorry. But always good to have people like that in our lives, right?
Oh,
as long
absolutely.
As we have them.
I am here to tell you.
Uh-huh. Okay, thank you.
Well, I appreciate y'all taking the time for small town farmers.
Absolutely. We love y'all. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Uh-huh.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
Kay Hudson with the Steel Plant Company. It's been a family-run company since 1953. They're proud of their sweet potatoes down in Gleason, Tennessee, also known as Tater Town. And, of course, for more information on sweet potatoes and the Steel Plant Company, please see our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, we visit the garden of Louisville Rose Society President Jim Preston. And, yes, there will be roses. You're listening to Homegrown in 89.3 WFPL.
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give with the gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Have a tomato, Plato. Here's cacciatora, Dora. Have some bologna, Tony. Everybody eats when they come to my house. I'll fix your favorite dishes. Hoping this good food will fill ya. Stay in the kitchen alone, work my fingers to the bone. You better eat if it kills ya. Pass me a pancake, man, drink. Have an hors d'oeuvre, Irvy. Look in the fenomenal. Everybody eats when they come to my house.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
The only word for this yard, Miss Wishy, is stunning. And it goes uphill from here. It's the home of Jim and Barbara Preston. Jim is president of the Louisville Rose Society. We're surrounded by 400 incredible varieties, cultivars, colors, shrubs, little guys, big guys, everywhere you look. Just an incredible situation. We're going to talk to Jim about this. Only began 8 years ago. It's really an amazing story, and you too can have these kind of roses in your yard.
It was easy to find the house for sure with the directions. All you had to do is look for the yard with all the roses, right, Jim? Thanks for having us out.
Well, you're welcome. We're glad to have you here. We hope that everybody out there listening can share in growing roses. They're not quite as difficult as everybody tells you they are.
So what was it that happened for you transitioning from just a guy that liked to garden and be outside and have, you know, shrubs and other things to being a really, really serious connoisseur of roses?
Well, I think I have a competitive nature in me. My business is kind of competitive. So I took the first rose to the state fair, won a blue ribbon, and got hooked, met a lot of nice people. We have a majority of our close friends are rose people, and we then ventured off into showing roses and met another couple named Jim and Barbara Zimmerman from Ohio. They've been doing this for 50 years. They've mentored us a lot, so... And we've just developed good friendships along with the fun of showing roses.
Well, Jim, what's fun about your story is this began with a single rose from a box store, as I recall.
That's correct. I did exactly, very shortly after buying two or three roses, what all people in rose societies tell you don't do. Don't buy a box rose and don't plant it as the company suggests. I bought a box rose at one of the warehouse companies and planted box and all, and it's still by my mailbox, and today it's absolutely gorgeous. So it goes to show you it takes a little luck too.
Sure, and when somebody tells you you can't, there's always 100 exceptions to the rule, right?
Yes, if you come to our Rose Society meeting and you ask a question, you'll get about 5 or 6 different answers, and all will be correct, probably for the most part.
So let's take a little closer look at the rose in general before we delve into your life with them. You know, what's the history of the rose and rose gardening in America? Was it something that sort of evolved more sort of, you know, for the elite, for those who have time? Were there medicinal purposes, that sort of thing? Do you know anything about that?
No, I'm not really sure that I know the total history. I know that it's obviously America's flower. It's the queen flower, and... every place that it's put, it obviously makes a great show. And as we know, the Rose Garden from the White House down to cemeteries and along old house seats in the country, you always see a climbing rose or a rambling rose, as some people call. So I think it was just, first of all, it's probably easy to propagate and move from place to place. As I can remember, my mother, and I still do, put a cutting of a rose under a fruit jar and let it there until spring, and then you have a total new bush. So
it's for everybody, huh?
Can you possibly articulate what it is about roses that is so appealing to you?
Well, obviously their beauty and their class every time, and all has a different class and look to them. And I changed from time to time. When I first started, floribundas were a kind of a bushy number of flower on a cane. I didn't care for floribundas, and now as I go along, I've grown to love them as much as any rose. The hybrid tea type, the florist type rose, is traditionally what people think of. It's just class and elegance. It stands out among all other flowers. I just think they're elegant. They're statesmen and queen look.
So, okay, you mentioned floribundas, hybrid teas, like the what everybody kind of springs to mind, you know, if you're getting a handful of roses at Valentine's Day, that sort of thing. But there are many other types of roses that are out there. Can you give us a better idea of how many different offerings in terms of style and form and function?
Well, certainly, I think everybody now is familiar with the newest rose out, and that's the Knockout, which has started out to be a red rose, and now they've developed into a pink, and a double Knockout, I think, as we drive, and especially on the like newer subdivisions, the landscapers are certainly putting them there. It's the most popular rose out today, and simple. I have one in my yard, and it says don't spray and don't fertilize, and I really don't, to try... to see if that's holding true, and it is holding true, and in fact it's one of the showiest roses in my garden, which sometimes make me happy since it doesn't need my help, right? It's growing on its own. But then there's a new class out called Earth Kind Roses, which doesn't need spray, doesn't really need anything. And the University of Texas, if I'm correct on, I believe I'm correct on this, did a study of roses, and they just put them out in sort of a desert area and said, grow, and we'll see what disease you get. I have a few of those in my yard, and they certainly, I don't spray them, don't really do much care to them. And they produce very well, very beautiful roses. One is, many people I've heard, it's an old rose called the butterfly rose, and it's a four single petal rose, and it just changes colors. A very pretty rose, so it's something you don't have to worry about. It's the hybrid tea varieties that usually require the attention in the spring.
So, yeah, tell us about the ones that require all your attention and all the paraphernalia and all the hard work that you do. Because these are the ones that sort of, I don't know, make the whole experience sort of special, because those are the roses that they shine in a different sort of way than the knockout because of the attention paid to detail.
Well, I think because they're like the florist rose, and when people give roses through the florist, they're all that hybrid tea look and form, and so they're usually elegant, very expensive, and we all like to give our sweethearts roses, bouquets, and that's what looks like it. In fact, we had a little story. We had 12 neighbors come in the yard last night, and they were touring. There was a young couple, and all of a sudden, they're over on a bench just sitting by themselves looking at this little rose garden, and they all said they're in love. They're admiring the roses. Well, I'm not sure that they were admiring the roses, but those roses meant that's what he would give to her or she to he, and Barbara and I now will give each other a rose bush for Valentine's Day or a special occasion.
So. Well, Jim, moving beyond the knockout, now you began, you showed us a spot on the other side of your driveway. You've got a quarter acre, basically suburban lot here, full of roses. But for people listening to this who have been afraid to move beyond the knockout, what do you suggest? Where do you begin? How do they begin to make it work?
Well, I think first you've got to find a rose that appeals to you. And what I would go to the Little Rose Society's meeting. That was the most intriguing thing to me, or helped me get going, as I planted about 25 roses, and I really didn't have a clue, although I've been gardening all my life, was I doing the right thing with these roses, and should they look like they did? And one night, four ladies from the Little Rose Society showed up for about 4 hours, and they gave me a great lesson. We're all four very good friends now. But there was many things that I wasn't doing correct. There were some things I was doing correct that I didn't have a clue. And so there's lots of advice in the Louisville Rose Society, and everybody's so open to give it out. So,
what are some of those common mistakes that people make first time out?
Planting in areas where they don't get sun, I think, sometimes. Sometimes people plant them a little close to the house, and they're not getting the sun. Maybe not watering them enough. Roses like water. They don't like to be sitting in water. They like good drainage. So it's important, you know, there's always this whole thing, as my friend used to tell me, you plant a 50-cent plant in a $5 hole. And I think that's pretty much gardening, especially with roses, is you want to prepare the hole well and let it drain good. So
how do you prepare your holes?
Well, I dig a big hole. I amend it with some kind of potting soil, and I like to mix a little soil in with it. If I have some organic matter, I like to put organic matter in it, and I'm now got a compost heap going, and so that will go into my holes. And so dig the hole about twice the size of the plant itself, and then amend it with good organic material.
And then you make your own alfalfa tea. The leaves on your rose plants, to me, are as impressive as the flowers themselves. They're just stunning, bright, shiny green, not a hint of black spot. What's that process to keep them like that?
Well, I think the process, first of all, as an exhibitor, there's this old saying, you've got to grow good roses to show good roses. My foliage, I think, all hinges back to a number of things. First of all, is the fertilizer that I'm putting into the ground, and I use some organic fertilizer. One is Rose Tone. I use Monty's Joy Juice. I use Monty's Joy Juice pretty much throughout the year in a number of ways. I root feed them, foliage feed them with Monty's Joy Juice. I think that does help the foliage. But the alfalfa tea gives me new basal breaks, gives me new canes on there. And within the alfalfa tea, it's a mixture of alfalfa meal and some fish emulsion, a little of Epsom salt, and some Monty's Joy juice. Come to the Rose Society, and we'll give you the recipe for you.
You know, that all to me is like a good nutritional boost to the roses. But what about, you know, they have this bad rap as being plants that are susceptible to black spot and powdery mildew and other things. Is there some sort of fungicide action that's part of that alfalfa tea as well? Or do you have to take measures to sort of control the fungus side of it?
Well, the fungus side is generally the hybrid Ttap. That's the ones who generally get it. Of course, there's a number of roses out there that are not as susceptible to funguses as the hybrid tea. But with the new products on the market today, Bayer makes a wonderful product. And if I were only growing 5 or 10 roses, they have a product called All-in-One, which is a fertilized pesticide and fungicide. Or they have 2-in-1, which is fertilized and fungicide. That's what I would recommend. Pesticides... you're going to have a few pests, and you don't want to kill the good bugs trying to get the bad bugs. So I try to use as little pesticide as possible.
So it sounds like it's not a really heavy spray regimen for you at all, other than feeding, feeding, feeding.
Well, feeding, 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 watering, watering, watering. But I do, I must say, since we do exhibit, we do, I spray about every 10 days.
To get people started, can you name a few cultivars you'd recommend, floribundas and just different kinds that have some success with early without feeling defeated right away?
Well, I've got a floribunda that's called Betty Boop. It's a single bright red, and, you know, it all depends. I was told when I planted that rose by a couple of people in the Rose Society that it didn't grow well here, that we'd tried it out the fairgrounds, that other people had. But I had the rose, so I went ahead and planted it, and you might have saw it in the corner yard there. It's about 6 foot by 5 foot. So sometimes it really depends location and area where the rose is. But I would not necessarily start out with hybrid teas. I'd start out with, if I were going to plant something first, I'd plant some knockouts, and maybe some of the earth kind roses. Floribundas will give you lots of blooms and not a lot of grooming required, not as much deadheading as. So that's kind of things I'd start out. There's, of course, miniature roses now, which a lot of people are downsizing, and you can have many more of those in less space. And they're much fun. They look like large roses, but just in the miniature size.
Now, you and Barbara have won more than 425 national, local, regional awards. Is that an inevitable part of the process, or sometimes can you just grow roses for your own enjoyment and you just kind of get pulled into the contest after a while?
Well, I think most people grow roses just for their personal enjoyment, to cut a few and bring in, sit on the living room table or the dining room table. We're kind of an exception to that rule. Most people in our Rose Society only grow roses for the beauty of having them in their yard and cutting and taking them to neighbors or someone sick in the hospital. Barbara, my wife, likes to take roses. She volunteers at Bab Deceased, and she generally takes a big bucket of roses once a week and passes them out to the nurses' station and in common areas around. We give a lot of roses to our neighbors. It always comes back in rewards. I get a lunch sent over by one lady with shrimp cocktails, and a vase of roses will always return me a lot more than I give. One of my greatest rewards one night that we gave a lady drove by a vase of roses. We knew she was having a dinner party, and about a week later I saw her car pull out of my driveway as the doorbell rang, and I went to the door, and on the door was this big apple pie that she had baked me. So I said, hey, what a deal, a vase of roses for an apple pie any day.
So there's a good payoff. And your wife, Barbara, is here, and it is you say that you predominantly do most of the rose stuff, but Barbara is involved. You'll go to the shows together. I know that you lay out sort of the whole scheme of things when it comes to the planting beds. But, Barbara, what do you feel like your role is in the whole rose escapades, as it were?
I'm the assistant to Jim and at the road shows. And then I like to see the enjoyment that people have with them, and that's why I enjoy so much taking them. As a cancer survivor, I work on oncology as a volunteer, and just to see somebody that is feeling very bad have the enjoyment of a rose.
I know you do a little kind of strategic placement out in the yard, too, because the front yard, the backyard, the side yard is full of roses. But you pretty much help in the design of the garden and the flow of the garden, because it really does have a, I don't want to stereotype, but it does sort of have a woman's touch in terms of that design quality. So, talk a little bit about that.
I think most people have raised beds, and we, being in Hirschburn and having it all in the front yard, we cannot have raised beds. I didn't feel that would be appropriate at all. So as you see, ours is just even with the ground, and I've tried to do it in a manner that, like you said, flowed. I've got the different designs of the beds, and they all seem to like the courtyard on the side with the fountain. And we've been had a lot of people tell us we've been fairly successful at that.
And then finally, you mentioned the Louisville Rose Society several times, of which you're president. How can our listeners join, and what's the benefit of doing that?
Well, first of all, we don't require you to be a member to come to our meetings. We have meetings at Nunley House every fourth Thursday of the month. We'd love to have you come as our guest. We won't have a meeting this coming month. We all have questions. I find out the more I learn about roses, the less I know. I always have a question of one of my peers at rose meetings about what should I be doing, how should I be doing this. And you'll just develop some wonderful friends, and so who all have the same common interest.
That sounds like one of the real advantages for sure. Thank you, Jim and Barbara, so much. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you much. We were glad you all came. We've enjoyed chatting with you.
Jim Preston is president of the Louisville Rose Society. He and his wife, Barbara, have 400 rose plants in their yard in the city of Hurstburn. For more information on Jim and Barbara, their roses, or how to join the Louisville Rose Society, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we've got listeners' questions and another chapter in Bob's Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I remain Bob Hill.
And we're back in the studio, and we are taking questions, and they're all questions about bugs.
So that means you get to answer them.
Okay, and I'm sort of lax about bugs, so I may not be the...
Yeah,
best
I am,
person.
Too. I've been very lucky this year. In fact, I've had very few so far that have plagued me. But that won't stop us from answering questions anyway.
Let's see. One of them's from Jan Winter, Bob. It says, looks like someone has sprinkled pepper on my broccoli plants, and there's evidence of bugs eating the leaves. The little broccoli heads are just now starting, about the size of a dime, down in the plant. Any suggestions about what those little black specks might be and what I should do to save my broccoli, if anything? Thank you. Love you both. Thank you, Jan.
Yeah.
I'm thinking little black specks.
Uh-oh.
Sounds like caterpillar poop.
Could you be more specific?
I mean, it does. It's always in especially since she says there's evidence of bugs eating the leaves.
Yeah, right.
There's always something coming out of something's going in. And the little black specks is usually a good indication to look around for little caterpillars.
The best of Dr. Wishy.
It's true, though,
yeah,
isn't
I know.
It?
I hear you.
Some things are a clear indication of something else.
I hope she still loves us, but I'm with you on that.
And I suspect, since it's broccoli, and to be honest with you, I'm growing Brussels sprouts this year, but I typically don't grow cabbage and broccoli and stuff because of the
bugs.
Cabbage worm.
Yeah.
And the cabbage worm... they love all those crops, and that's likely what you're seeing. So here's my suggestion. Inspect the plants.
Yes, ma'am.
Pick off what you see. You can use floating row covers to cover your plants to protect them.
That would be like those white pieces.
The white pieces of cloth.
The floating sound like was in the water or something.
Yeah, but they're called floating row covers because they, in theory, are supposed to be secured floating above your plants.
Gently float above your plants.
Not like literally, but...
Sounds like a concert.
And not to sound like a broken record when it comes to pest management, but neem.
Neem.
Does work, as far as I know, for these little caterpillars.
Neem.
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 And it's just safer than putting seven on or something creepy like that.
Okay. And since you actually did research on this next question, I'm going to ask you that one too.
Okay.
It's from Jerry T. He's a question I might be able, we might be able to help him with. I heard, not sure where, that there's a vegetable slash water mix you can spray on tomato plants to keep the bugs from eating the leaves. Is this true? How do you make the mixture? Would it be like 1 teaspoon vegetable oil to how much water? Thanks, Jerry T.
I don't really make up my own concoctions either. And I suspect that many people don't recommend making up your own concoctions. Isn't that true, Bob?
Yeah, some of them actually work, but a lot of them are kind of homemade, mm-hmm. passed down remedies that mm-hmm. may not work. But
or you can do some other damage to the plant
right.
because, you know.
Or yourself.
You don't do the right mix or whatever.
Like gasoline and water is not a good idea.
Yeah, exactly. So I think the general rule of thumb, basically, 2 tablespoons of soap, like dish soap,
okay.
to help it stick.
Yep.
2 tablespoons of vegetable oil to 1 gallon of water. And you can okay. try that. It might deter certain insects, but it probably won't deter everything. And to be honest with you, not a ton of stuff really eats tomato leaves, does it?
No, not leaves.
So
I've had trouble with the
I have flea beetle problems more than anything else.
Or you know, the raccoons or something mm-hmm. will come out and eat the
yeah.
plants.
Because a little eating of the foliage isn't so yeah. bad anyway.
The tomatoes.
So yeah, try 1 tablespoon of oil, 1 tablespoon of dish soap to 1 gallon of water and see if that moves the bugs on.
Okay.
All right. If you have a question, you can get a hold of us in various ways, right, Bob?
You betcha. They can email us at homegrown@wfpl.org. Call us at 502-814-8246. And I'm not going to tell them how to write because I'm mad at them. They don't write us anyway.
Okay.
So no more this week.
No more this week. You'll have to stay tuned for that for next
yeah.
week.
Okay.
All right, Bob, what do you have for us this week for the plant story?
It's another 1,000-year-old puzzler.
Great.
I enjoy doing this because I learned so much myself, and the names that stick around for so long,
yeah.
you just don't appreciate 1,000 years.
And we lose the meaning, don't we?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Or why, even. It's the Maltese cross.
Lychnis.
Lychnis, actually, Chalcedonica.
Chalcedonica.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
Chalcedonica. I just got the H a little louder than you did. Got some other great names, Jerusalem Cross, Dusky Salmon, Burning Love, and Nonsuch.
Huh.
Maybe the last two are related. The Nonsuch
yeah.
and the
burning Love. Exactly.
Yeah. Actually, Lychnis means lamp, but you knew that.
No, I didn't.
You're the Latin lady.
Hmm.
And Chalcedonia, or Donica, I'm sorry, refers to a place near Constantinople.
Mm-hmm.
Istanbul was Constantinople. It was alleged that Louis IX brought the plants back from Jerusalem to France after the Crusades in the mid-13th century.
Hmm.
Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing.
It's a native of Russia, Mongolia, northwest China. Maybe that's why it doesn't like heat as much as we think it would. It's a great plant. Mine's about 3 feet tall, bright red flower, and clusters of maybe 10 or 50 petals.
And kind of like an orangish red, don't you
yep,
think?
Yep, it comes mm-hmm. in different colors. There's mm-hmm. orange red, there's pink, and there's white.
Hmm.
Fold apart sun, needs water. And it'll fade away in bad soil, but
okay.
you got to watch that. But it's really a neat, bright plant. It can become invasive even. And Thomas Jefferson planted this thing in Monticello in 1807.
Mm-hmm. So definitely history long history.
Yeah. So named because the flower looks like the Maltese cross, mm-hmm. which is an 8-pointed figure used on the crosses since the First Crusade about 1,000 years ago. The knight's 8 points symbolized loyalty, piety, frankness, bravery, glory and honor, contempt of death, helpfulness toward sick and poor, and respect for the church.
Hmm.
That's a lot of load for a flower.
Sure is.
Comes with a poem.
All right.
The Maltese Cross, 1,000 years old. Some may wonder and some may not care about a pointed flower with a cross to bear. Loyalty, piety, glory and honor, bravery, honesty, all that to ponder. While planting a flower with petals quite red or orange or white, just to honor the dead, who mounted big horses long, long ago, then off to the deserts to conquer a foe. Did they wonder back then what we still wonder now, if the lasting results of their foolhardy row would be mostly forgotten by modern-day man, who would soon find reasons to do it again?
Hmm. You're really good at this.
A little bit of politics on that
yeah.
one.
Yeah, Maltese cross or Lychnis Chalcedonica.
1,000 years later, we're doing it again.
That ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, another garden visit. This time, it's a maze. And I did say a maze.
Homegrown is produced by that soft rose-peddling Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.